Okay, we are still in Romans 1. I know no one's going to believe me, but if I get as far as I think I'm going to get today, we'll actually be in Romans 2. So, and once I get going, I'll just keep going. So let's open to Romans 1. And actually, I did not know about the whole Reformation 500-year anniversary. Peter called yesterday about the hymn, and he's told me that. And I thought, how fortuitous, because the passage I'm going to teach on today is the end of Romans 1:17. And let's read that. Romans 1:17. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. I'm not much of a Reformation historian, but I do know one thing about the Reformation, and that was the key verse for the Reformation, for Martin Luther. And when he read that verse, remember last week we talked about the righteousness of God, and we saw the righteousness of God, his attribute is like a bud. It's closed off. No one else can enter. If you try and break through, the bud dies. And if he allows any sinner in his presence, the bud dies. He ceases to be God. He ceases to be the infinitely holy one. There's no access to God's righteous, his attribute righteousness. And that's what Martin Luther, as a monk, kept seeing. He's seen the ultimately righteous God, perfectly righteous in condemning and punishing sinners. And it didn't go any farther than that, and that was tearing him apart. And then he comes to this passage, for therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as is written, the just shall live by faith. And he described it as the gates, I think he said the gates of paradise opening, because he then realized there's a gift righteousness of God, a faith righteousness of God, whereby God declares right wrong sinners because of the righteousness of God encapsulated in the cross work of Christ. So I thought it was very fortuitous. I happened to be preaching on that message, and it turns out this is the week we're recognizing and appreciating the Reformation. So we're going to pick it up from there, and just keeping in mind this righteousness of God, you know, we saw last week his attribute righteousness, the bud of that righteousness has been unfurled. So it's wide open now for all to see in the cross work of Christ. That's why Paul keeps saying it's being revealed, it's being manifested, it's being made known. God's righteousness before Christ's cross work was a bud enclosed unto himself with no access to sinners. And then through the cross work of Christ, he unfurled that righteousness. And not just so we could appreciate it, but then is extended it to all people, and those who believe actually participate in it. And that's what we talked about last week, the righteousness of God. And this week we're going to go on now and look at faith. So we've talked about faith before. So we're going to look at this. Verse 17 again. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. And I talked about this before at the beginning of Romans 1, but I just throw it up here to bring it back to our thinking. Faith is a word that is really a group of words with based on the same Greek word. And you really need to go by the context to know what it's referred to. Usually, when we just go up to someone, if I came up to you and talked about faith, you'd probably, your immediate response would be your faith, what you believe in, your belief. But, you know, you can't believe something unless there's something to believe, to state the obvious. And so you can only have faith if there's the faith. Paul calls that the body of truth for today, the faith, what we actually believe. You can't believe something if there's nothing to believe. God has given us a body of truth for us to believe, and that's called faith and the faith. But then the faith has to have a content. It's not just that you're believing what the scientists say or what you heard on the news last night or what your grandparents had always thought or whatever. You're believing something that's in the faith, and the content of that is the faith of Christ, the faithfulness of Christ, the person and work of Christ. And that is the basis of everything. So when you read the word faith in Paul's writings, it really, there's an emphasis put on it based on the context, but it really involves all of them. You can't have faith without the faith, and you can't have the faith without the content of it, which is the faith of Christ. They all go together, and when we respond positively to that, that's called our faithfulness. So they're all tied together. It starts with the faithful work of Christ, the personal work of Christ, that then has now been recorded for us in Paul's writings. That's what we believe. That's our faith. And when we respond positively to it, that's called faithfulness. So I just wanted to kind of bring that back to our thinking with faith, because in this passage alone, the word faith occurs three times. And so it's a critically important word. And even when we talk about God's righteousness, it's a faith righteousness. And everything revolves around faith. So verse 17, it says, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. Now there's a couple ways we can look at that. Most commentators, at least most commentators I'm familiar with, view that as kind of a figure of speech. It begins with faith, it ends with faith, and everything in between is faith. It's all of faith. And that's a factual statement. Everything in the believer's life is based on faith. But I don't think that's what Paul's probably really driving point here. Some dispensational commentators will bring out the point where they think this is talking about the transition and use the second word there, that this is referring to the faith. And we're having a transition from the body of truth that belonged to Peter and the 12 and Israel and her prophetic program, and that's being transitioned now over to Paul's truth, the body of truth God gave to Paul for the church, the body of Christ, and the mystery program. And you know, that's true too, and probably when I started doing this years ago, that's probably the one I would have gone with, because we've already looked at verses 1 to 7 and saw that there's this great transition. He's pointing us away from Peter and the 12, and he's planting us firmly in Paul's apostleship. But now, what I think is the real reason for this faith to faith, if you go over to chapter 3, verse 22, just keep your finger here. We're only going to be at chapter 3 for a second. He actually picks up and develops what he says in verse 17, this faith to faith. I think he kind of tells us what he's talking about in this faith to faith. Verse 22 of chapter 3. Even the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ, unto all and upon all that believe. And I think what he's expanding on this faith to faith unto faith concept, and it's going from the faith of Christ, the personal work of Christ, what he accomplished for us, and all of that is now being extended to those who believe. My own personal choice of those three is this has to do with the faithfulness of Christ being extended to the faith of the believer, making us participants in his righteousness and everything associated with him that we saw last week. So I think that probably refers to, well, everyone probably knows Hebrews 11:1, where it talks about the faith is the ground of hope, and it's not based on sight. It's the ground of hope. It's what your hope rests on. Now, when we say hope in the Bible, when we read about hope in the Bible, it's not, you know, like I hope our favorite sports team wins this weekend, or I hope I win the lottery when, you know, the chances are virtually nil. When he talks about hope in the Bible, it's the confident expectation in something. And as he says in Hebrews, that faith is the basis for a confident expectation, and it's not based on sight. Well, if it's not based on sight, it's based on faith, where do we get that faith from? Since we're already in Romans, flip over to Romans 10, and let's just read this. 10:17. Romans 10:17. So then, faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. And so the second thing we want to keep in mind about this faith, it's the substance of hope. It's not based on what we see around us. It's based on what God's word tells us. And that's true faith. That's the faith Paul's talking about and other writers in the Bible are talking about. So let's go back to Romans 1:16. And let's read this last phrase that had such an effect on Martin Luther, and that probably this phrase and this verse could probably be called the ignition point for the Reformation. The just shall live by faith. Now, if you take those three compartments, those three clauses or whatever they are, the just shall live by faith, it's almost like, you know, you can put those together any way you want. You can almost juggle them up, and any way you put them together, it comes out right. You know, we know that some people say it's the emphasis on the just by faith shall live. And that's certainly correct. And the just shall live by faith. And that's certainly correct. Martin Luther, I think, was his special emphasis was the just shall live by faith. In other words, the just are made alive by faith. And that's certainly right. So this is one of those phrases where there's a lot of ways of looking at it, and that doesn't detract from its meaning, that adds to its meaning. It's such an important text for visualizing that. This actually encapsulates all Paul's teaching. Some people say when he's referring to the just by faith, it's kind of what he's doing in Romans. And then when he talks about shall live by faith, he's talking about when he uses this verse in Galatians, where they started out in faith, but then they were trying to continue life, living the Christian life, on the basis of works and law. And that's probably correct, too. Some people even look at Romans itself as being a commentary on this verse, where they see the just in Romans 3, by faith in Romans 4 and 5, and shall live as you go through Romans 6 to 8. And so there's all kinds of ways. This is a very rich phrase. And what I thought we'd do today is actually go back to Habakkuk and kind of take a look at the origin of this phrase and what Habakkuk was doing with it. Now, most people, when they talk about this phrase, they say Paul liked it from Habakkuk because it fit his theology really well and he could use it to make various points in his theology. And I think that's right, but I think for those of us who rightly divide, there's even a bigger reason why Paul seems very fond of Habakkuk. I don't know if I'm saying his name right, so if there's any Hebrew scholars and want to give me a better way to say it, that's fine. Let's go back to Habakkuk 1. And I don't know if it'll be any help, but it's right after Nahum. And right before Zephaniah. So if you have an old Scofield Bible, it's page 955. Habakkuk 1. And now, what I wanted to do was I thought I'd bring everything together. Last spring, we talked about the courses of punishment that belonged to Israel in the Old Testament. And there was a lot of interest in that, and several people asked if I could do more with that, if I could bring that out, you go over another prophet and show how to use those courses of punishment. So what I thought I'd today, as we're wrapping everything up, is kind of bring this back to our memory. These are the courses of punishment, and this is the timeline for Israel. Now, of course, the dispensation of grace would not be there. Just imagine that not being there. That's us today. And what I thought I'd do, since several people had asked, is just take Habakkuk now and look at it and see if we can't really understand it clearly based on the courses of punishment. Now, you remember from the courses of punishment in the past, Israel's history was under five courses of punishment. Remember back at Sinai, they contracted with God to deal with them on the basis of law. And we went through this in a lot more depth in the spring. And then also John has actually a whole series that goes into great detail of this on the website. If anyone just piques someone's interest and they want to look at it a little more in-depthly, I'd highly recommend you go there. But Israel, remember, they came through the wilderness. It was Israel under Moses, but not under the law. And God had brought them along as on eagle's wings and had turned them into the people he wanted them to be. And now they had a choice. They had a choice between continuing to fly as on eagle's wings or to go under a law and make themselves into the people God wanted them to be. And they chose to make themselves to be in the people God wanted them to be. We will do all that you command. And there's a humor. There's nothing wrong with humor in the Bible. Anytime you have finite sinners trying to figure out an infinite God, you're always going to have confusion. You're always going to have working at cross purposes and things like that. And there's a humor because he just brought them through the wilderness, teaching them the lessons. They couldn't even keep two commandments, easy, schmeasy little commandments about collecting manna. And they get to Sinai a few days later. And they say, we will do all your commandments. We will bring on over 613 commandments that are going to penetrate into every aspect of their lives and will require an army of rulers and judges to try to implement. And we're going to do that. They hadn't learned their lessons. They were rebellious, and they declared they would do what only God can do for them. And they contracted with God under the law for God to treat them on the basis of performance. For obedience, they would be blessed. For disobedience, they would be cursed. And Leviticus 26 gives us the five courses of punishment. We know their history was not one under the blessings because they were rebellious, sinful nature, constantly left God. Their history was under the courses of punishment. And we had the first course of punishment in Judges, and then the second course of punishment came on, and each one got more intense and more intense and more intense till we get to the fourth course of punishment. And then the next one is the fifth course of punishment. And this is the most important one for us to remember, because in the fifth course of punishment, there's no turning back. For each of the four before that, if they responded positively, he would end the curses and bring on the blessings. Once the fifth course of punishment started, there was no turning back, because he's going to set in a time schedule over the fifth course of punishment. And he reveals to the prophets that time schedule. To Jeremiah, he revealed the Babylonian captivity, which is the first event of the fifth course of punishment, and he told him it would be 70 years. Then, the Babylonian captivity would be 70 years. Then, Daniel is in Babylon now. He's a younger guy. He's in Babylon. He's reading Jeremiah, and he says, wow, we're almost at the end of the 70 years. I wonder if God will give me the rest of the time schedule. And that's exactly what God did. God gives Daniel the rest of the time schedule. The total amount of time is going to be 560 years. Jeremiah announced a 70-year captivity. Daniel's given the rest of the 490 years, and it's divided up into the time periods are the 70-year Babylon captivity, the 49 years under Medo-Persian rule, the 400 years of the silence of God, then the 34-year ministry of Christ, and then the 7 years of tribulation. And those are the five basic segments of the fifth course of punishment. Why do we spend time? This is just a bunch of archaic history we shouldn't care about. This, if you can just remember this fifth course of punishment, the prophets will blossom. They will open up before your very eyes. Because when the prophets come on the scene, they really only ever talk about six topics. And let's just go through those. And then we're going to look at Habakkuk. They really only talk about six things. Invariably, when the prophet opens up and begins his prophecy, he begins with the condition of the people in his day. What's going on? And they're always wrath, we're going to call it wrath-worthy. They're deserving of the next course of punishment. They're deserving of the fifth course of punishment. So just keep that in your mind. And then when we go to Habakkuk, we'll try to apply some of these things. So when you open up a prophet and you have no idea what they're talking about, you can now at least go in and say, well, this must have something to do with the condition of the people in the prophet's own day. And that's how all of them start out. Then it's going to proceed to the events of the fifth course. Then they're going to give a block of information on the Babylonian captivity, the 70-year Babylonian captivity. Then they're going to give a block of information on the Medo-Persian rule. Then they're going to give a block of information on the God's silence. And actually, this one, Amos, Malachi talk a little bit about this, but, you know, there's not a lot to say about a period of silence, right? You know what the Israel leaders were supposed to be doing during this period of silence? They were supposed to be studying these prophets so that when John the Baptist came on the scene and broke the silence, the leaders of Israel would know exactly what was going on. And then the fifth thing they're going to be talking about is the earthly ministry. They're going to give a block of information on the earthly ministry of Christ with a special emphasis on his death, his cutting off. And then they're also going to be talking about the end time tribulation period and then as that goes into the kingdom. So those are the six things, and really it's only five because there's not a lot said about the period of silence. So there's five topics that the prophets are going to be talking about, and they give blocks of information, and they pretty much, not always, but pretty much go in that order. And so let's open up to Habakkuk, and let's just see this in action. See how this will open up our thinking and understanding of the prophets. Because I got to be truthful, years ago, before I knew anything about this, I'd go to any prophet, and I'd read about 10 verses, and I'd be like, I don't even know what the guy's talking about. I mean, and then you get a commentary, and they try to apply it to today, and it's like all confusion, and nobody knows what they're talking about. And when I discovered this, the timeline and everything, and these courses of punishment that are outlined in Leviticus 26, and then this time schedule that's put in place in the fifth course of punishment, it really can open up your prophets. They can become very, you know, they sound so extreme sometimes, but it can actually be enjoyable. And maybe we'll see that a little bit today. We'll have some fun with Habakkuk and really, really kind of appreciate it. So let's open up to Habakkuk 1. And let's just read without me saying anything else. We'll just read the verses here. The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see, O Lord, how long shall I cry? And thou wilt not hear, even cry unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. Why do you show me iniquity, and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that raise up in strife and contention. Therefore the law is slacked, and judgment doth never go forth. For the wicked doth do compass about the righteous, therefore wrong judgment proceeds. Okay, now, years ago, I would have read that two or three times, and I would have said to him, I have no idea what he's talking about. But now when we remember the first thing here, he's looking at his own people, and he's announcing their wrath worthiness. He's making known the state of the people. Hey, look what the kind of words he's using here, violence. And he's talking about iniquity and sin and spoiling before him. He's looking out at his own people and he's seeing injustice and sin and iniquity. And verse 4, therefore the law is slacked. They're ignoring the law. They've thrown away the law. They're going on their own way. There's contention and envy and strife and violence and iniquity in the land. And Habakkuk's asking God, how long is this going to go on? Why aren't you doing something about this? And then verse 4, where it says, the wicked doth compass about the righteous. The righteous are being persecuted by the unrighteous. The unrighteous, the wicked, are ruling the land. And this is Judah. We're not talking about some Gentile nation. This is Jerusalem and Judah. And this is what's going on with his own people. And he's announcing, when you realize these courses of punishment, he's announcing the fact that they are wrath-worthy. God would be perfectly right to bring in the fifth course of punishment. And Habakkuk wants to know, why haven't you done it yet, God? What's taken so long? How long are you going to make me look at this? And I think we can be pretty certain that if the wicked are persecuting the righteous, that Habakkuk is being persecuted. Because he's looking out and he's seeing violence and all this problem. And he's asking God. He's still with God. He's praying to God. He's communing to God. He's together with God. He values the law. And he's looking out and he's seeing the total opposite of that. They've left God. And now they're controlled by their own vain imaginations and darkened hearts and going after the lusts of their own flesh. And it's destroying the society with injustice. So that's the state of the people in his day. And he's talking to God about it. And now when we come to the next thing, those are the four verses he's going to talk about that. Now, as we begin the next section, we can kind of just begin thinking in our heads, what would be the most likely thing for him to move on to? Anyone want to guess? The Babylonian captivity. We can just begin to say, okay, it opened up with the condition of the people in his day. You read it, and he's giving you the condition of the people in his days. And now that he's done that, I don't know, it'd be logical to think he might be moving on to the Babylonian captivity. So let's see what he says. So he's prayed this to God, and God is going to give him an answer now. Verse 5, behold, ye among the heathen, and regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans. You know what another term for the Chaldeans is? The Babylonians. He's gone right on to this second subject. He's talking about this now, and he's talking about the Babylonian captivity. And the Chaldeans are another word for Babylon. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards and more fierce than the evening wolves. And their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from afar, and they shall fly like an eagle that hasteneth to eat. They shall come for all violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity as the sand. And so he's gone right on course here. He's moved right on to the Babylonian captivity. And he's announcing the fact that these wrath-worthy people are worthy of the first event in the fifth course of punishment, which is the Babylonian captivity. You see how this opens up Habakkuk? I mean, I don't know, maybe other people can read a lot better than me, but I used to read these passages, and I never had any idea what he's even talking about. And here, when you know these things, they just fall right in place. Now, the thing with Habakkuk is, it is, especially as we move into chapters 2 and 3, there's some poetry. And I know nobody likes poetry, right? Although I did hear some young men in the parking lot quoting Shakespeare pretty well a few weeks ago. So they'll go nameless, though, because I don't know if that will be embarrassing. But, you know, it's okay when we come to these prophets, a lot of it's poetry. There's some poetry, poetic stances, and we ought to be able to have some fun with it. We ought to be able to understand this poetry and appreciate this is God's literature, true, but it's also human literature. And he wrote this through human agency. And there's Habakkuk's personality is going to come through a little bit here. And so what I'd recommend, another key, once you go beyond the biblical things, a personal key I have for reading these prophets is to just kind of loosen up a little and kind of get almost like you're watching a movie, that kind of thing. Kind of, you know, we were at Bed Bath & Beyond yesterday, and I saw they had these scents you could plug in, and it was the aroma of popcorn. And I thought, maybe I'll bring popcorn and just put that in the walls, and it just kind of will fill the room up. It'll feel like we're in a movie theater. But I thought, no, everyone would probably get so hungry they would leave. So I decided not to do that. But, you know, when I read Habakkuk 1, and you during the week this week, you read it this way and see if it doesn't really open up and you actually have fun with these prophets. Because the first chapter I kind of see as an audio feed. It's almost like Habakkuk's on the telephone with God. And it's an audio feed. And then you go to the second chapter, and all of a sudden he's added like video to it. You have an audio video display. And then you get to the third chapter, and it's like God has brought Habakkuk right into his very presence. If we kind of look at it from that standpoint, Habakkuk's on the phone, he's calling God, and he's like, hey God, you know, things are getting pretty bad down here. When are you going to do something about it? So God picks up the other end, and he's like, well, let me tell you, Habakkuk, why I'm taking so long, according to you. Because the next thing that I'm going to do is the Babylonian captivity, and Babylon has come swooping down on their horses that are faster than leopards and more vicious than the evening wolves, and they're coming in like vultures for the prey. And they're going to conquer Judah and Jerusalem, and they're going to take your people to Babylon. God is saying, that's why I'm waiting so long. Because once that fifth course of punishment starts, there's no turning back, and the first step is the destruction of your city, temple, and your people are going to be carried away. He's announcing this fact, and it's almost like a telephone conversation. Now let's hear what Habakkuk says back to him in verse 12. Now keeping in mind that at the beginning of this conversation, Habakkuk's asking him, what's taking you so long? Why haven't you done anything yet? Verse 12, art thou not from everlasting, O Lord my God, mine Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, thou hast ordained them for judgment, and O mighty God, thou hast established them for correction. Now he's not so sure he likes God's answer. He's like, you're too pure, you're too holy. You know, you're going to use them to judge us. You're going to use the idolatrous Babylonian nation, idolatrous Gentile heathen pagans to judge us. Verse 13, thou art of purer eyes. You can't look on them than to behold evil and canst not look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously and hold thy tongue when the wicked devoureth the man that is more righteous than him? And it's like Habakkuk's now back on his end of the line. He's like, whoa, wait a minute. How can you use the idolatrous heathen nation like Babylon, vicious as it is and wicked, to judge a more righteous nation? You know, the implication is there, no matter how bad Israel got, they wouldn't be as bad as Babylon. And so now he's, if you have, get into the narrative a little bit here, you can see he's like saying, well, maybe I was a little premature and wanting God to rush down. And because God's holding back in his long suffering. Because once that fifth course of punishment comes in, there's no turning back, and the first of the Babylonian captivity. And now Habakkuk is like, well, wait, you're so holy and pure, you can't use an unrighteous nation to judge us. And then God's going to have a big answer to that. But for now, Habakkuk, at the end of chapter 1 here, he's on the phone. God, you're holy, you're pure. How can you use a less righteous nation to judge a more righteous nation? And he ends, and it's like God hung up on him. And pick it up at verse 1. It almost sounds like he feels like God hung up the phone on him. Chapter 2, verse 1. I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will watch to see what he will say unto me. And I shall answer when I am reproved. And so, you know, if someone hangs up on the phone, don't you kind of like get a little worried after the fact? You're kind of a little nervous, like, how mad did I get this person, right? Because, you know, when you hang up the phone on someone, that's pretty serious. Now let's just get the picture here. He's going to go up. He's followed through. He gave information on the state of the people in his day. Now he's talking about the Babylonian captivity. God's announced he's going to begin the Babylonian captivity, and he's going to keep talking about the Babylonian captivity. So he's going to break up this message now into two. His first part was the fact, well, Habakkuk, the reason I'm not coming too quickly is because when I come again, it's going to be with the Babylonians, and they're going to wipe out your nation and carry your people back to Babylon. And now, in the second place, he's going to kind of take up Habakkuk's complaint. How can you use a less righteous nation to judge a more righteous nation? And he's going to say, don't worry, Habakkuk, I'm going to judge the Babylonians as well. Of course, we don't have time, even in such a short prophecy, we don't have time to go through the whole thing. So the Babylonians are now going to come on the scene. They're going to swoop down. God raised them up. He empowered them to judge Israel. But what they did is they then went beyond that mandate. They went now to the whole world. And they said, you know what they told the world after God had raised them up and empowered them? That it was their idols that gave them the power. And that it was their glory, Babylon's glory, that was going to spread out over the whole earth. That's what's going to set God in motion to say, nope, they've overstepped my mandate. I'm going to then destroy the Babylonians. And that's what he's going to begin talking about in chapter 2. So let's pick it up at chapter 2. This is the part where I say, let it kind of loosen up, sink down in your chairs, get your box of popcorn, because I kind of envision this tower. He goes up in this tower, and the lights are off, it's dark, and all of a sudden, God turns the night sky into a screen, a movie house, we'll call it. And he puts on this screen, he's going to put five little vignettes. He's going to put five movie clips. Has anyone seen Lord of the Rings, those movies? Well, if you go to the second and third one, what do they always have at the beginning? They always have these little video clips just to kind of jog your memory, so you kind of, because they're a year apart, the movies come out so far apart. And, you know, they'll have a little snippet on a certain battle or a certain thing that's happening on, or the, you know, the fires in Mordor and all that kind of stuff. Or there'll even be a future thing where, like, Frodo is worried he's not going to be able to get the ring in the fire. And then he gets a vision of what his home, the Shire, is going to look like. And it sounds a lot like what happened to Israel. They're going to be taken captive by the orcs and all that. And there's all these video clips, and you're just watching these one things. It's jogging your memory, and they're just maybe 30 seconds, 1 minute each. That's what God's, I think, doing in Habakkuk. He's going to give five woes, and he's going to set it up with something the Babylonians are doing, and then he's going to show them how he's going to take them down. And he's going to give five movie clips of what's happening, what he's going to do to judge the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. And so first he announces what he's going to do to judge Israel. He's going to raise up the Babylonians to judge Israel. Then he's going to explain and show and put in a movie before Habakkuk what he's going to do to the Babylonians, because they've overstepped his mandate. They're conquering the world. They're crediting their power to their idols, and they're spreading their own glory over the earth. Let's pick it up with these woes. Let's look at verse 6, chapter 2, verse 6. You'll notice Habakkuk 2:4 is where we have our verse from Romans and Galatians and Hebrews. And I'm going to just skip over that for now, because we're going to come back to that when we get to the end. Verse 6, shall not all these take up a parable against him and a taunting proverb against him? And the hymn there is Babylon. Now something's changed. They've overstepped their mandate. And now people are going to take a parable against Babylon and taunt Babylon and say, woe. Here's our first woe. Woe to him that increased that which is not his. How long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. Shall they not rise up suddenly and shall bite thee and awake thee and shall vex thee, and thou shalt be but booties for them? Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee because of men's blood and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. Think of this as a video clip. You remember those Babylonians were coming down on horses faster than leopards, more vicious than the evening wolves. They're galloping through the land. They're conquering everything they can. They're destroying everything in sight. They're taking captive everyone they can. They're taking everything they can get, destroying everything they can get. And you see that in this picture, this movie clip. And then all of a sudden, you see, it's like you see the dead nations reaching up out of the dirt they've been trampled in, reaching up and grabbing the Babylonians, pulling them to the ground and defeating them. The very nations that they trampled in the dirt are going to come out of the mud, out of the dirt, and trample the Babylonians, destroy the Babylonians. When I sit and think about this, this amazing picture of how God describes this battle and how he's going to bring the Babylonians down, because they spoiled the nations. They went well beyond his mandate to judge Israel, and they gave credit to their own gods and were spreading their own glory. So now that goes off. Second woe, verse 9. Woe to him that covets an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. Thou hast consulted shame to thy house by cutting off many people, and have sinned against thy soul. For the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. Now, you know, we read this, and we think it's God's word, it must be really serious, but, you know, I don't know about you, if you think about this for a second, it's really creepy. Because this is right up there with Edgar Allan Poe. Edgar Allan Poe probably got it from this. Now we have this picture, this video clip. They've all gone out, they captured everything, and now we're seeing them back home. They're heading back home. It says in verse 9, woe to him that covets a covetous to his house, and he sets his nest. A nest is where you go. It's your home, right? It's where you go to sit and rest. And now we have a video clip of these Babylonians having destroyed everything in sight, take the people captive, take the plunder back to Babylon. They're sitting in their castles, their palaces, and they're just, let's use our imagination. They're reclining on their sofas, being fed grapes by beautiful women. And all of a sudden, out of the dark, in the middle of the night, the walls and beams and ceiling starts talking to them. And is proclaiming their guilt for the violence and their bloodshed. And the very rock in the wall calls out their blameworthiness, and the actual beam in the structure answers back in approval and support. And the whole thing just starts tumbling down upon them. Could you imagine waking up at 2 a.m. having your house condemn you for something you did? I mean, you'd be kind of startled, right? And that's what he said, right when they're back there reclining and resting and they think they've got the world in their hand and they're all relaxed and they're going to wake up in the middle of the night and the very rocks of their buildings and their palaces and their walls and the timbers and their ceilings are going to be calling out to them their blameworthy and guilt and just fall in on them and be destroyed. Let's look at a third one. We probably won't go through all these woes, but I just wanted to give you a taste for this. I don't know if challenge is the right word, but I'd encourage you to go to the prophets and not go just this very serious thing, but just kind of go to enjoy them. And what they're trying to say will really open up. And so we're still talking about the Chaldeans. Let's go to verse 12. Woe to him that builds a town with blood and establishes a city by iniquity. Behold, it is not of the Lord of hosts that the people shall labor in the very fire and the people shall weary themselves for very vanity. So here we have, boom, another video clip. And now we've moved. They're not out in the fields and they're not reclining in their palaces. Now they're out building cities and they're using the blood and violence of their captives to build their cities, and they're taking advantage of them, and there's bloodshed everywhere, and they're building their cities based on this. And God looks down, and it says, this is not of the Lord. And what do we remember from Ecclesiastes? Apart from God, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. It's going to all start on fire. All their work would have been for nothing. And you just see the place burn down, Babylon burning down. And then, and this is where it gets really good, then the movie theater goes black in verse 14. And then there's a voice from heaven. Verse 14, for the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Babylon wanted to fill the world with the knowledge and the glory of Babylon. And now he's given three movie clips about his destruction of Babylon, and he announces this was to accomplish the fact that his glory, the Lord's glory, is going to cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. It's not going to be Babylon's glory. Verse 15. Then the movie camera comes back on again. The screen lights up again. Woe unto him that gives his neighbor drink and puts a bottle onto him. So the next woe, we're going to get a video clip of drunkenness, sexual immorality, and debauchery. And that all the stuff that produces is just going to come and bury their glory and destroy them. Let's go down to verse 18 now, because I think we got the idea of these woes and the vignettes. And now it's important to get the contrast here, because up to this point, it's been very noisy. From the first verses where he announces Babylon's coming, you hear the horses galloping, the chariots clanking, the spears and the swords, noise everywhere, destruction, buildings toppling, cities being wiped out, noise everywhere, everything's noise. Now verse 18. Now he's brought these judgments on Babylon, verse 18. And then it's almost like there's just one person speaking. What profits the graven image that the maker thereof hath graven it, the molten image and a teacher of lies that the maker of his work trusts therein to make dumb idols? And now all of a sudden we're going to see a lot about how all of a sudden there's silence. Verse 19, we get our fifth woe. Movie camera comes back on, and now instead of seeing buildings collapsing, cities being destroyed, people wiped out, the whole world afire, verse 19, woe unto him that saith to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone, arise, it will teach. Behold, it is laid over with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in the midst of it. And he ends this movie captions by announcing the fact the only thing left when he's done is a Babylonian on his hands and knees praying to a dumb idol in which there is no breath. God has not only taken down the nation Israel, he's taken down their dumb idols as well and proven they had no power. He says earlier in verse 14 that it's his glory that's going to cover the earth, not the Babylonian. And then he comes and now talks about their gods and says, it wasn't their power that raised up Babylon. It was my power, and they overstepped it in crediting them. There's all silence now. One poor Babylonian guy trying to get his idol to do something. and there's no breath therein. And that's where we're going to leave the Babylonians, destroyed, but not only the nation, but its gods, quote, small god, small g, obviously gods. Verse 20. And now this is where I think it changes again. The lights go out. Habakkuk's still in his tower. He's ready to open his eyes. He opens them. Verse 20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. He's silenced Babylon. He silences God and turns off the movie projector, ends the movie show, and then it's almost like Habakkuk now is actually in God's presence. He sees God sitting in his holy temple, and the world is silent. Verse 1, chapter 3. Now let's see what God does with Habakkuk. Let's just start at verse 2. O Lord, I have heard thy speech and was afraid. O Lord, revive thy work in the midst of years, and in the midst of years make known. In wrath, remember mercy. That's Habakkuk's prayer. And then God's going to do something with Habakkuk. I kind of envision this. He's like saying, okay, Habakkuk, let's go for a little, why don't you follow me while I make a little tour in my on earth. And he's going to now describe something. Everything up to this point, if we remember the courses of punishment, he started by describing the people, describing the condition of the people in his own day. Up till now, he's been talking about the fall and rise of Babylon and the Babylonian captivity. And now he's going to take Habakkuk on a little road show, I guess. And he's going to now take him to the end times. And he's going to tell Habakkuk, he's going to show Habakkuk, you know, the Babylon in your day that we were been talking about up to this time that I used to take Israel captive, that's not really what I'm talking about. He said, what I'm really talking about, what happened in your day, Habakkuk, was just a foretaste. It was a rehearsal for something that's going to happen way out there at the end time when he deals with end time Babylon in Revelation 16 and on from there. And he's going to now bring him down. We're going to see a little bit of the second coming of Christ. Habakkuk's going to be watching him coming down and do this. Verse 3, God came from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. He's already indicating he's coming from the south of the nation, just like he did with the Exodus and with the wilderness wanderings. Now listen, his glory covered the heavens and the earth was full of his praise. So much for the Babylonians, their praise and their glory. The earth now is and heavens are covered with God's glory and praise. And his brightness was as a light. He had horns coming out of, and there was hiding of his power. This is a theophany. This is an appearance of Christ. The second coming of Christ, he's coming to earth. He's heading into Israel, heading towards Israel. Now let's flip over verse 6. So he's moving down, he's moving, he stood and measured the earth, he beheld and drove asunder the nations. At the second coming of Christ, it's not going to be like the first. It's not going to be peace, it's going to be destruction of all his enemies. And he comes down to earth, and it's like, well, one sweep of the hand, he wipes off the nations on that side, one sweep of the hand, he wipes the nations off on that, his enemy nations off on that hand. And the everlasting mountains were scattered, and the perpetual hills did bow. His ways are everlasting. And he's walking from mountain to mountain, and every time he picks up his foot, that mountain crumbles. And he goes to the next one and the next one. And you just, his powerful God now is coming in wrath and judgment. But let's pick it up down at verse 12. Thou didst march through the land in indignation. He's coming in his wrath and judgment this time. And didst thresh the heathen in anger. You went forth. Now, why is he doing all this? What is the end goal of this? Verse 13. Thou wentest forth for the salvation of thy people, even for the salvation of thine anointed, with thine anointed. Thou woundest the head out of the house of the wicked by discovering the foundation under the neck. And we don't have time to develop this now, but that means It's just like what he did with the first Babylon. Remember, it said he wiped out the nation, and then that last woe wiped out their gods too. And here he's saying that he's now sweeping aside the nations, the enemy nations. He's conquering all his enemies. And he's saying at the same time he's gone all the way down to the neck, it's not just the people and the nations on earth, but the spiritual powers behind those nations. And he's wiping them out too. And let's just close because we got to get back to our verse. Let's see what Habakkuk's response now is. When I heard, my belly trembled, my lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered into my bones, and I trembled in myself, and that I might rest in the day of trouble when he comes upon the people and he will invade them with his troops. So what was Habakkuk's response? He's looking at the second coming of Christ and seeing Christ in his wrath and his anger, and his insides turn inside out. We might say today his bones turn to jelly, and he just collapses. He can't take it. So now we've come to the key passage in this whole thing, out of this whole thing. And he's left, he's collapsed on his floor, he's seen the condition of, he's been looking at the condition of people, he's been looking at the judgment of Israel by the Babylonians, he's been looking at the destruction of Babylon, and then he was looking at the destruction of end time Babylon, and he collapses, his bones have turned to jelly. 17. This is all he can say. Although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be on the vines, the labor of the olive tree shall fail, and the fields shall yield no meat. The flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls. When everything's hopeless, when nowhere you can look, where there's nothing you can look and see anything hopeful, verse 18, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he will make my feet like hinds' feet, and he will make me to walk upon mine high places. Here's living by faith by sight. I mean, wait, I said that wrong. Here's not living by sight, but living by faith. No matter what it looks like on the outside, Habakkuk was going to find his peace, his rest in God, and rejoice and joy in him and find his strength through him. And that's the just shall live by faith. Flip over a page to chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 4. Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him. That was the people of Israel that he was looking at and the Babylonians. But the just shall live by faith, not by sight. Everywhere Habakkuk looked, in all his visions, all he saw was wrath, anger, and destruction. But he was going to come through those because he wasn't going to live by sight. He was going to live by faith. When he looked at his people, he saw horror and perplexity. When he looked at God's judgment on his people, he was anxious. When he looked at God's judgment on Babylon, he was fearful. When he looked at the end-time destruction God was going to bring, his insides turned inside out and his bones turned to jelly. But when he stopped looking and looked only at what God had told him in this vision of being carried through, the righteous shall be saved, the just shall live by faith, he found peace and rejoicing. Now, living by faith, not by sight, living in complete reliance on God and his word, for his salvation, strength, and care. And now you're probably maybe wondering what all this has to do with Romans. Well, here's what I'll conclude with. We talked about this earlier. Most people say that he really likes Habakkuk because it's particularly easy to take this phrase and kind of use it in his theology. It goes well with his theology about justification and faith and living by faith. But I think there's even more than that, a more important fact that we need to take into account, and this is what's going to lead us into chapter 2. Habakkuk is similar to Paul in certain ways, not in the message, not in programs, not in anything like that, but there was a certain characteristic of Habakkuk. He was preaching between the time of the revelation of God's wrath and the actual occurring of that wrath on earth, the actual implementation of that wrath on earth. And so is Paul. Paul comes on, let's flip back to Romans, and we'll close with this. Romans 1, look at verse 18. Romans 1, verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed, and that's present tense, is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Right now, God's wrath is being revealed. Certainly it was revealed when Jew and Gentile alike joined hands at the cross and crucified Israel's Messiah and the world's creator. And God is now, and he's announced their wrath worthiness, and you can even see at the end of Romans 1 that we know it because you can look at the condition of the world handed over to their own sins and iniquity. And Paul comes on the scene, and God has announced the revelation, is revealing his wrath against the world, but he hasn't implemented the wrath yet. And look over at chapter 2. This is my tie into chapter 2. You've all been waiting for, I know, for a year. Chapter 2, verse 5. But after thy hardness and impenitent heart treasureth up unto thyself wrath against the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God. Paul is between the revelation of God's wrath and in verse 2, 5, the implementation of that wrath when his righteous judgment will be revealed. And he's warning them. And Paul's ministry is now, he's between the revelation of God's wrath and the implementation of his wrath. God has sent him to announce to the world that God is holding back his wrath a little while longer. Look, it's almost sloshing over the levee. It's almost breaking the levee, and God's holding it back a little while longer so that we might have every opportunity to believe, to receive, to hear and believe his message through the personal work of Christ. God's holding back his wrath a little while longer, and that's what he told Habakkuk, not with the same content or the same specifics, but he's saying, this is why I'm holding back my wrath. This is why I haven't dealt with your people yet, because when I do, that's coming, the day of the Lord's wrath. And that's where Paul is. And when we get into chapter 2, he's going to be emphasizing the point, don't miss this opportunity, people. Don't use this to do other things. Don't use this to be judges. Don't use this to produce your own self-righteousness. Don't use this opportunity for that, because in a very short while, God's going to bring the day of his wrath. And my ministry here now is to announce to you the day of his salvation. In that day, he's going to be judging, condemning, and punishing his enemies. In this day, he's offering grace and peace and salvation to his enemies. Don't miss this opportunity.